position number 16808, rule 10.
Spittle's rule 10.
Yes, this intelligence officer who told us, he said, they've had to formulate this plan of holding. He said, because what's actually happened, the two American beaches have not gone according to plan. He said, and one in particular is almost a total disaster. He said, the armour has been lost 90%, so they've got no armoured backup for the land forces that have landed. He said, and they're trying to protect that end of the beachhead from the German armour that is coming in. He said, and to do that, they've got to create the impression that the main attack is a direct attack, forward movement on the left flank. He said, and that's what's got to be created. Well, as we all know, that was what created, although in later years, it's not always been appreciated. And Montgomery and the British, or the Allies, the Canadians and everybody else, have all been blamed for being slow in forward movement, when in actual fact, it was a deliberate plan that I know, I was told by this intelligence officer on about D5, that this plan was already formulated then, because of the failure on the American sector of things not going exactly to plan. And anyway,
you were told that at Fairham.
I was told that at Aldershot, now at Aldershot in the gymnasium, by this intelligence officer. And I think this could have been more emphasised to more people than I recollect were ever known about it, you know. And when people talk and you read book about it, you know, it annoys me, because I knew from this on D5 that this plan was in operation, and yet it's been criticised ever since as being the wrong thing, that we were not pulling our weight, we're not doing as good as we should, we'd lost the fibre and all that rubbish. And yet by D5, this intelligence officer in the gymnasium at Aldershot told me this was the formulated plan by Montgomery to make the beachhead work. But anyway, we, as I say, by about D6, we moved down to Fairham, and it was terrible weather, raining. It had quagmire down there by the troops that had already gone through the camp. And the only consolation was that it was always a joke in the forces about the NAFI, who supplied a good service, and the girls that worked there, you know, were diamonds, really, you know, the work they did and the hours they put up with and the service and everything. But strangely enough, you talk to blokes and they never seem to talk about the girls being glamorous. They always give you the impression that the NAFI girls were sort of quite safe from being chased, as it were. And when we got down there, honestly, they were all like film actresses. They were, these NAFI girls, they were crackers, they were. And all the lads said, God blimey, where they found all this lot from? You know, where they been hiding them? But we had several days down at Fairham, and then we moved into Gosport, and the weather had eased up, it had become fine. And I always remember that we must have been in some sort of an estate of where you went down one street, round the bottom, back up the other street, round the top, back down the next street, and we seemed to be going up and down streets. And we spent one whole night actually in Gosport itself, waiting to get down to the beach, well, to the landing. And everybody's making a great fuss of us, and it's amazed me since that the enthusiasm of the civilians wanting to do as much as they could for you, because I mean, we was going on D10, so we're talking now of sort of the night of D8 and the day of D9, because we loaded up on during the night of D9 on the barges. And the civilians were as enthusiastic as though we were the first ones that had ever been there. You know, they were taking you into their houses so you could have, because we were dirty and scruffy by now, having been on the road for sort of 48 hours in the tanks, and you couldn't go anywhere, you know, and you needed to use toilets and that. And they were taking you into their houses, and some of the lads were having baths and showers, and they were, although they was rushing, they were supply with food and, you know, sandwiches and tea and all that sort of thing. And, you know, it's funny really, because, I mean, they'd had thousands of troops gone through Gosport, and I was still showing this fantastic enthusiasm, like, you know. But eventually, of course, we get down to the barges themselves, and I don't know, I suppose it was too late for the Germans anyway, but they must have had some bombers about, and they must have realised what was happening. And I would have thought they'd have had some bombing done along the south coast, you know, where these landings, the loadings were taking place, because when we got down during the night at Gosport, it was arc lights, it was lit up like bright as day, you know, to keep everything moving at a fast pace. And of course, you have to load everything on backwards. What we landed on were landing craft ships. They were these American, big American landing craft. They were like a ferries, really. They got the bows at the front, shaped like a ship, and they opened, and then inside you've got a watertight door, which opened, and then you had the ramps themselves, which came down, which you loaded and offloaded on, you see. And they were double deckers. So, and at the back, they got these massive lifts. So the lorries and soft vehicles went in first, drove in, up the lifts, and then reversed up to the front and then loaded the top up with all the soft vehicles. And all the tanks were in the bottom, you see. And the Navy were doing all the work. They chained all the tanks down with these cross chains back and front and all that. And eventually we woke up in the morning and we was out at sea in a convoy, you see. And it was funny, I had an impression when I've talked to people afterwards that there hardly could have been a landing craft that went across that didn't have a tank break loose from the chaining in the holes. Like. Because we had a Cromwell break loose and they could hear this crashing about. But they wouldn't let us go down to do it. The Navy chaps, they had to go down and secure it again. And my animosity with old Tom was still working. And after we got out into the sea, and it wasn't a rough sea, as I recall, it was more of a high swell. And the boats were sort of yawing up and down and rolling from side to side and just gradually steaming across. And I suppose it would be about 5 o'clock and we was going off the Isle of Wight, and we got over there sort of Teton off the coast of France. And of course, naturally you get some people who like the sea, they're not seasick, but the majority of course are seasick. And we had these what they call spew bags, you see, like they were the forerunners of plastic, really. They were like a sort of a waxy sort of material, not paper. And everybody was issued with them, you see, to bring your heart up in your breakfast. And they got toilets, you see, in the bows, both sides, for port side and starboard, as the Navy blokes call it. And they got all these toilets, you see. And of course, it wasn't long before they was in a shambles, like with blokes wanting to be sick but not making it before it had to come up on the floor and all that, you see. So they were right shambles. And Tom come, he was deliberately looking for me, come there, he said, "Ah, there you are," he said. "Get some of your lads," he said, "and you'll get some brushes and stuff," he said, "and keep them ablutions clean." So going over to Normandy, I was in charge of a ablution party, keeping these toilets swilled down, because they swashed out to sea, you know, your buckets of water down and all that, and swilling out to sea. And that was my job, going to Normandy, was being in charge of the ablution party, to keep the ablutions reasonably clean for blokes to keep using. And anyway, incidentally, the last job I did, official job in Aldershot, we had a church parade at the garrison church, and Tom came round again. He said, "We've got to supply a church party," you see, because when we had a church service, I always had to have a party go down and issue the hymn books out, put all the hymn books out, and then when it came to the collection, you had to have chaps go along with a wooden bowl, you see, and hand it in, and they go along the line, back up the other line, and they collect it and hand it on to the next lot, you see. So you had this party whose responsibility it was to put out the hymn books and the hymn sheets, and then when they'd gone was to collect them all in again, put them everything right, tidy the church up, and then march your party back to the garrison, you see. And that was my last official job at Aldershot, was to be in charge of the church party at the last church service we had at the garrison church. And another thing was, because I'm reverting back here to Aldershot, at the theatre, Garrison Theatre, they had these big stars of the day coming to entertain, you see. And there was a lot of Canadians there when we were there. And I always remember, because you get all these strippers and things now, but the main one then was a girl named Phyllis Dixie. But she wasn't a stripper. She was a fan dancer. And for those old enough to remember her, she had these huge fans. And so although she was supposed to be naked, whether she was or not, you don't know, because she always wore the fans, so you never knew. But she used to come on, and Phyllis Dixie, so she always on this doing, like, you know. And all, she's through being a man, I suppose, she's the only one I remember of all these big artists of the day that came to entertain the garrison troops, you see. And in the towns everywhere, they used to have these water tanks and the AFS to use in case of incendiary bombs and fires, you see. And naturally, in Aldershot, they had a big one in one of the main streets or a square or something. And a big one quite a large one. And the Canadians had been playing up, and one of the Canadians, the Red Caps, had got him. Anyway, he managed to get away from them, and they were chasing him, and he dived into this big AFS water tank. And he was swimming up and down, like, you know, and he was teasing. Although he was supposed to be drunk, he was really enjoying himself. You know, he was fully battle-dressed, boots and everything, and he's flailing about in this water tank. And it was deep. I mean, they were 10 feet deep, some of them, like, you know. And he was deliberately coming along the side, and these Red Caps were trying to grab him. And I always remember, because at the finish, he got three Red Caps in there with him, trying to get him out. And I don't know how it finished, because it was such a laugh, you know. But it's never forgotten, this Canadian. And when they used to get trouble in some of the pubs, they used to have these, it seemed to be the Canadian, it didn't seem to be British Red Caps, it seemed to be these Canadian Red Caps who were policing the Aldershot at the time. And it used to be comical when I was troubled. We used to go along to watch for the comical way they used to be out, the Canadians. And I used to just go in, these, and they was all big chaps, all 6 foot, and they used to have these short truncheons. And what they used to do, they used to go in the pub, and they didn't bother to look at anybody or see who the troublemakers were. I just got the nearest one to him, got hold of him, the first one, got him with two hands, dragged him out, snatched him, like, so he sort of temporarily to get dizzy, like, you know. He just snatched him, handed him on to the next one. He immediately clobbered him and handed it on to the next one, and they piled him up in the street, all unconscious. And it didn't necessarily be the troublemakers. It was just the one nearest the door. I used to clobber them. And of course, because we were there for some time, some weeks went by, it was the practice to get your wives or girlfriends down, you see. And my wife came there several times to Aldershot from Northampton, and which indicates how safe life was those days. I mean, her and her pal used to come down from Northampton on the train to London. They had to change at London to get onto the Southern Railways then. And yet they were never any thought to being molested or anything, you know, and yet the trains were solidly 90% forces of some discrimination or the like, you know. And she came down several times, and they found some, well, we used to try and find the digs, you see. And it wasn't long before, you know, all the regular boarding houses what took these girls in, like, you see. And although they were supposed to make sure that you were married and all that, I think that was a bit loose, you know. But there was one occasion which I always remember, because Al Followell, who was one of the lads in the troop, he was a troop, he wasn't in my troop, Al Followell, he was in another troop, but he was a lad I sort of got to know with, like, you know, from Northampton. He was a Northampton lad. And He was always one for getting home. The least excuse, opportunity, it was shoot or phone, with or without a pass. Alf didn't mind at all, you see. Fortunately, I mean, he did get picked up with a red cap, so with 8 passes and that. But so usually my wife and his wife used to come down together, you see. And this time we just couldn't find anywhere where they could be accommodated. It exhausted everywhere, you see. So we sent a telegram to say not to come because, you know, there's nowhere for them to stay, you see. So that was that. We was up in the lines, up in the barracks, and suddenly somebody come down and say, "Reg, Alf, there's a couple of women up the road asking for you." I thought, I wonder who that is, because we sent a telegram not to come, you see. We wasn't to give in aid to going round with the ladies in the town lot, you see, so I thought, and we goes, of course it was my wife and Al's wife, you see. "Didn't you get a telegram?" So they said, "Yeah." "Oh, there's nowhere for you to stop." So they said, "Well, it don't matter, you know," and all that, and kidding us on, but it turned out what had happened. And it's amazing how common sense sometimes goes wrong. Because when you came out of Aldershot Barracks, as I recall it, you came out the station, and it was a long courtyard leading down to the street, all cobbled. And down the right-hand side were some houses with little gardens in front. Little bay window houses with little gardens. And if you're sort of looking for digs for someone, you think, well, it's no good going close to where the station is, because the first thing I do, get out, try, come out and go to the first station and see if I've got any rooms. So it's no good there. You've got to get out into the town to try and find somewhere that hasn't been tapped, as it were. So, and we'd exhausted everything, as we thought. And what had happened, they came out of the station, and there's this little row of cottage run houses, and I just went to one of these. You know, the last place you would ever expect. Knocks on the door or whatever, and a little old lady came. She's ever so tiny little lady, she was a widow, lived on her own, and she didn't normally take people in, because, you know, with all these young virile soldiers and that, you know, about, and all the girls, she sort of thought, well, that's not my world, you know, because to us, she was probably about 60. To us, she looked about 100, you see, at our age. And she told us, and when we talked, because they came down, and of course they stayed there a couple of times afterwards, at the same place, you see. And I was talking to her, and she said, "No," she said, I've never done it before," she said. "It wasn't my thing I'd do," she said, "but one of the girls," she said, "your friend's wife, she looked so worried," she said. "I just hadn't the heart to turn them away." Now, my wife always looked well, you see, and yet she was the worrier. Now, Al's wife was pale, slim, and, you know, looked full of trouble. And she couldn't care a sod. You know, she was that way, you know. And it was my wife who was worrying. Al's wife weren't worried. And afterwards, she flogged on me. She said, "I told her I had this telegram come," and she said, "It's not." So she said, Alf Wall said, "Well, we'll go down anyway, you know, we'll get somewhere, we'll go down, you know," she said, "even if we had to go in the barracks with the lads, you know," sort of thing. So it was her that, and yet she was the one that this old lady thought we were worried, you know. But so that sort of thing used to happen, like, you know, the wives and that used to come down. The only thing, my wife's always been a bit prudish in the sense of loyalty, you see. And so, of course, we'd still got some of the yeomanry lads from the terrier days who she knew, because Northampton was a small town those days, and most young people in that age group knew everybody by sight from going up the park or down the theatres or the cinemas, and all, you know. And even if you didn't know them personally, you knew them. So he comes from Northampton, or she comes from Northampton, you know, even if you didn't know them, you see. And so my wife had got to know all the years that we'd spent in England, the training years, backwards and forwards to different places and catching the bus or the train back to where we'd come from. You got to know who was married and who was his wife and all that, you see. And of course, when we gets down Aldershot, the first time my wife came down and we were walking around the town or what's that, going to pictures or whatever, and we spotted two or three of our lads who my wife knew, their wives, and she said, "That's not his wife." I said, I wouldn't know. It's not, she said. Are you sure? Well, we're quite indignant because some of the married men were not as righteous as they should be. Like, you know, they got girlfriends at these different places. And my wife was spotted up, like, you know. So I said, well, the best thing is to keep your mouth shut when you get home, like, you know. But least said, soon as mended type of thing. But anyway, all this went off at Aldershot. And then eventually, I say, we went down to Fareham. And eventually we got on the landing craft, and eventually we stood off the French coast. And it was about tea time, evening time, and it appeared, because they have a beach master in charge, and they appeared, to what I recall, to have a system of lights. They must have had some radio contact with the boats as they came in, you know, the captains and all that, which we were not aware of. But you could see these different coloured lights operating along the beach. And they must have meant something to somebody, I should imagine, when a boat should come in or stand off or whatever you say. Probably the wireless communication, they'd tell the captain that when he saw, they'd give him perhaps a set of lights to watch, and when the certain light came up, that was his signal to come in or something, you know. And we're watching these lights, and we started to move forward. We were about half a mile off the beach, and we stood there, you see, for a start. We came in and took up station, I suppose, waiting for their instructions when to come in. And then suddenly the old engine started up and we started to move in. And then suddenly these two, I say Messerschmitts, but what they were, I don't know, but two German planes came in along the beach, and the old cannon, boom, 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 boom. And they must have hit something of importance because all the lights started going and we stopped and just hove to, you see. And we were standing off about the best part of half a mile, and we was close by one of these big monitors, and these battleships, you know, they're far and inland. And we had the experience of them at night. We didn't hear them in the daytime because of the noise. And although there was noise at night, it wasn't the same atmosphere as in the daytime. We could hear these monitors firing, these battleships firing all through the night, you know, these shells. And what we used to hear is we're sort of perhaps 10 miles inland or a bit further, because they used to fire about 20 miles inland, you see. And you'd be there, and as you sort of kip down for the night, bedded down, you'd hear something. And you didn't come home. They didn't get this thing like you get on the pitch. You didn't get this screaming noise. You got this sort of throbbing like a displacement of air. You didn't go, and then disappear, like you say. You didn't get this ear shrieks or what they're supposed to have done. It was just a displacement. And well, you could hear them at night for a long, long time, far inland. And anyway, there was one of these not too far away, and it was firing. And I was watching, and I thought to myself, they're firing rather quick, you know, because these massive guns, and firing broadside, you see, they were lying broadside to the beach, and they've got these big turrets fore and aft, and they were firing, although they got like four big guns in each of these big turrets, they was only firing two at this end of the boat, and then two the other end, and then the other two would fire, so there was more or less a continuous fire every 15 minutes to 20 minutes. And I thought, Christ, they're firing quick, you know, because I'm imagining how much it must take to reload and get the shells up with all these, however they do it, you know. And I thought, I didn't expect them to fire as quick as that, right, you know. And I was talking to one of these matelotes under doings. I said, Christ, they're banging some stuff in, aren't they, mate? He said, yes, he said. I said, they're quick now. So he said, well, it's only because they're sitting on the bottom. So I said, what do you mean, sitting on the bottom? He said, well, he said, when they come in, they're not going to move. He said, they're going to be permanently there. He said, what they do, he said, they put them where they want them. He said, then they sink, fill the bilges and sink the boat, you see. So it's actually sitting square on the bottom, although it can be floated, refloated at any time. He said, now, if they were at sea, he said, I don't know if you ever noticed, when you see these old First World War pictures, he said, and you see this line of battleships and they're all firing their guns, he said, have you ever noticed, he said, it looks as though the decks are almost awash with the water. He said, yet if you see a line when they're travelling, they're always high out of water when they're speeding. I said, yeah, I suppose you're right. They said, that's because when they're travelling, they empty the bilges. So there's less of the boat in the water, increase the speed. He said, when they're firing, and they usually fire broadsaws to use the full power, he said, they fill the bilges as far as they can to make the firing platform as steady as it can, and it increases the rate of firing. He said, because if they fired broadside when they're moving, the balance would be so upset, he said, it'd be ages before they could set the gyros to fire again. He said, that's why they do it, he said, and that's why they're sitting on the bottom, he said. And while they're on the bottom, he said, it's like almost the same as firing shells from a gun in the field, you know, like artillery. He said, because they fire, he said, and the recoil is only on the gun. He said, there's very little recoil actually with boat movement itself. It's all in the gun. And he said, that's why they can fire so quick. I said, oh, it's interesting that, like, you know, something I didn't know about. It was very interesting to know of it. But we sat there anyway, and time went on and it got dark. And it must have been about 11 o'clock, and all the lights started flashing again. And the old engine started up, and we went in, you see. Well, of course, we weren't going to fire or do anything, because, I mean, D10, the fighting was well inland, and, I don't know, probably 10 mile or something like that. And we landed, and they got the old tapes out where to guide us where we'd got to go. And they got some military police, DRs, and a couple of jeeps, and guided, took us inland, up where they wanted us to go. And when it got light, we were in a field, and there was two squadrons of our regiment, because what had happened, because of the bad weather and the two Mulberry Harbours being knocked about at that in the early stages with the bad weather, all the landing, they couldn't take every bit of equipment that they initially wanted. So our regiment, when was it Aldershot, instead of taking the whole regiment, we left B squadron and B echelon, that was the bulk of air transport, behind at Aldershot. And A squadron and C squadron, so I was in A squadron, so my squadron and C squadron, and A echelon, which is the lorries and the vehicles that are used to convey material from the B echelon to the fighting tanks when you're actually in action, they went, and so they'd only perhaps be about half a dozen or so lorries or vehicles, and their recce troop, which was about 14 Dingo Daimler scout cars. So what actually went from our regiment was two squadrons, A and C, A echelon and the recce troop, B echelon and B squadron were left at Aldershot, you see. And so that's all they could accommodate with the transport available to the regiment. And that's what landed in Normandy, you see. Well, then, when it gets light, the two squadrons were around this field in the orchards and all that. And we got all this here ceiling on, you see. Well, when you land, it's all got to come off if you're going to start fighting. And what was done, every bit you put on, except the tank commander's box, he got to chuck that off himself. The rest of it, you've got a cordite cord, which was under the tape, and then finally it was connected electrically to a switch in the turret. And what was supposed to happen, when you landed, the commander at the appropriate time was supposed to press the button, or whatever it was now, and you'd have this explosion with this cordite, and all this ceiling equipment would all be blown off, and the tank would immediately become tank-worthy, fighting, you see. And so when we landed in the dark, and that, when we got light, there we stood all around this field and that, you see, with all this gear on, like, you know, all these big chutes and things. And nobody said anything what to do, so, you know, you didn't press the button because we weren't going to do anything. And then they came in, we had to dismantle it, take it all off for salvage. And blokes are bloody good, aren't they? I said, well, put all this stuff out. And of course, all the Northampton lads at that time, the scrap merchant in Northampton, if you got pre-war, was George Emmons. He was the biggest scrap merchant in the town, you see. So anybody got any rubbish, I say, oh, Smith Emmons will have it. You know, it was all Smith Emmons would do, you see. So, of course, the Northampton lads, I said,